we're very pleased we could have this opportunity to meet with Dr. Lee. Life is a matter of accident. When he and Herb Brownell met at the Jefferson Bar after the Alfalfa Club meeting event.
But Jefferson Bar is very important.
Tony.
And we've had some contact with him. He is, as you know, a distinguished medical scientist with great authority on cancer and other aspects of medicine. And he and Herb Brownell struck up a friendship and have had several dialogues. Herb Brownell was here yesterday, but has gone back, I think. So Dr. Crispell is the logical person to conduct this discussion. I think he was the conceptualizer, visionary, idea man who started us down this track, and we would like to follow whatever course you want to follow, Ken.
No, I think it should be up to Dr. Lee. He's the guest. I think some of us would probably be interested in why you took
God, don't ask me that question.
Especially with two psychiatrists in the room. Yeah.
We have two shrinks, in case you need.
Well, I can use a shrink. The reason I took the job is quite a long story. I won't give you all the details. I happen to be a long-standing friend of the president's, and not a particularly close friend, but a long-standing friend. I was really more friendly with most of the other members of the family than I am with the president, but we're good buddies. So he came to me originally in beginning of January, and as he's done with a few other of his policy jobs and his assistant jobs, he tried to get some people to take two hats. So he offered me a job that I was wildly crazy to take. He said he wanted me to be take the physician job and run the medical operation in the White House. And number two, to take the special assistant job for health policy in the White House and do both of them together. At this stage in my life, I'm really, after 30 years of clinical practice at Memorial, and cancer work, I was wearing out a little bit on that end of it, and I was very interested, particularly in the policy end of things, healthcare financing, where we go with a multitude of issues that revolve around that. And I've already gotten myself involved with that. But in the translation through the Chief of Staff's office, I have gotten, as they say in Washington, sununu'd. And
it's wonderful. That's a new one.
So he has taken a lot of the people that come in there and. He cuts the job back, cuts the rewards back, and cuts the access back, and he cuts this, and he cuts that, and he sees how far he can cut it to get you to not, you know, to take it. It's like the frog pond theory. He wants the water hot enough so the frogs are jumping, but they're not jumping out. So, I was a little bit unhappy with the way it was handled, so I initially turned it down. And because the policy end of it disappeared, basically, formally it disappeared. And Bill Roper, Sununu got Bill Roper back in, who was head of HCFA.
Of what?
HCFA. Healthcare Finance Administration.
He's going to be here next week for the dedication.
And he has spent many years in the nuts and bolts of healthcare financing, and perfectly legitimate choice for Roger Porter, who was who is the economic and domestic policy advisor within the White House. So he left HCFA. He's back in his old job, which he had in 86 as the healthcare policy thing. And I wasn't sure that what was left was a good fit for me. But the president talked to me about it. He said that the doors would open and that he wanted me to come in and continue to be his health advisor on a more informal basis. So I did it. I got my foot in the door, and it's interesting, and we'll see what happens. I was on the President's AIDS Commission, and in the course of that year, it was a very red-hot, heated year. The cauldron that surrounded us there. I met a great many people in the health world who I've become good friends with. Roy Schwarz, your buddy,
mm-hmm.
Is a guy I particularly like, and I'm trying to.
Did you counsel with him, or did you meet him through AIDS, or just through his job?
Through AIDS.
Right. Roy, in case you don't know, he was on our commission as called, he's Jim Salmon's number one person in the AMA. Roy is still in his 40s, a very bright guy. Yeah, he's called, Jim's title is Executive Vice President. I guess Roy's called Assistant Executive Vice President, but he runs the shop. Jim's tired.
He's particularly he runs it for education.
You bet.
And so forth.
Trying to get the academicians back in the AMA.
Right. And he is Ken has terrific access to him. You're obviously very close friends. And he is a very, very bright, well-spoken guy. I mean, at the Miller Center.
We've invited him five times, and each time something.
We followed it up one time.
Yeah.
But he's a very nice guy. I'll tell you a story. You know, none of us forget things like this. When we started off on the AIDS Commission, as you remember, we were widely thought of to be the biggest bunch of fools that had ever been put together. The New York Times wrote an editorial that said, "This group of people is about as likely to write a good report on AIDS," then they were referring to Admiral Watkins, "as a as they would be to run a nuclear submarine." And my career certainly was out for grabs, and the first people I went to was the Institute of Medicine, and Sam Thier, who's the head of that, instantly, he's the first guy that came in. He said, "We're behind you all the way. I'm throwing everything open to you, all our resources," and through them, and he publicly castigated one of the major AIDS researchers in this country for going after us publicly. With his help and with his assistance over the next couple of weeks, I was able to put together the outline for our work, for what we did in the commission report. And that was the single biggest thing that was done. But the number two thing is I didn't have hopes for the AMA.
Mm-hmm.
I'd never had anything to do with them in White Tower Medicine, really. And I made some blank phone calls to Salmons and so forth. I ended up talking to Roy Schwarz. And this guy immediately turned over everything in the AMA to us. He offered us secretaries, personnel, knowledge, people, flew into Washington. And that backing, right there at the very beginning, also was a major, major turnaround for us. And I've always been very, very grateful to him. Very, very grateful to him. But anyway, in that AIDS Commission, I got to know a lot of the key players, and they're being very helpful to me now in my attempts to get out from just the nuts and bolts of that office. And use the office of the physician of the president for more advice and policy and personal advisor to the president type role. There was something that was written in this report, the Wilson Center report, which I also won't forget, and it's why I originally turned the job down. At the end of the, excuse me, the Miller Center report, at the end you have a thing on the president's physician. And the second paragraph was something I was unable to deal with for a while because it's so accurate. And it says, this commission has been shocked at the low rank and sometimes the seemingly low esteem accorded to the physician, and not just in the current administration. That is something I have been dealing with, I am trying to remedy since the first day I got on the job. And I think we're making a lot of headway with that, particularly since I got the 100% backing of the president. When you look historically at this, as all of the people did at the Miller Center, right from day one, the physician has never had anything to do with labeling somebody as being disabled. I mean, the Wilson's wife ran the country for 18 months. God knows who ran the country during the last year of FDR's life. It was said to be Harry Hopkins, and Harry Hopkins was in a hospital and carried the Yalta on a stretcher. in Ken's book here, they say it appeared really that there was nobody that was healthy at Yalta. Stalin had just had a heart attack. Churchill had had either a CVA or a heart attack or both. Both? What was it?
Coronary, for sure.
Coronary. Roosevelt was unable to sit up for more than 2 hours at a time. Harry Hopkins was carried in there. I mean, this is, and the world was being divided up. you can go down the list of the presidents, and it's a little scary from my point of view to see how what a normal thing it is to run into major problems with our president. And it has, the physician has never really, up until very, very recently, the last go-around with Reagan's operation, I think it hasn't really struck the proper role here. And I mean to do that, and this document, you know, Ken's book, this book, both Ken's books, and this Miller Center report, is what I've been waving around in front of everybody. We're going to hold a meeting shortly in the White House with Quayle, Bush, Sununu, Gray, the counsel of the president, Mrs. Bush, who I consider to be a very key player here.
GB number one.
Yes. And I've talked to her, actually, about this quite a bit. And I said our goal here, and she agrees.
Excuse me, can I interrupt?
Yeah.
I'm interested in how Lou Sullivan fits into this via Mrs. Bush and that role. Sometime.
Well, he's in his role largely because
of
Mrs. Bush. Yeah.
But this is what I'm wondering about on the policy business.
Lou Sullivan, I don't know how that's going to work out, but one of the first visits I took, since I hadn't known him, was to Lou Sullivan's office.
Mm-hmm.
I've seen him twice, and we are two peas in a pod, really. I mean, we have
fantastic guy.
Yeah, very. We're very similar in our thinking.
His son's fourth-year student here.
Is he really?
Yeah.
I asked because I knew him very well. I was on his board at Morehouse at the very beginning and helped get him there.
I see.
So I've been watching
his that was on the pause, though.
Yeah.
Not so much the care of the president.
Yeah,
I don't think he would.
But they overlap. They overlap.
Knowing what?
Everybody knows that Dr. Detmer has joined us. We introduced everybody else. Our vice president.
Hi.
And everybody knows Lou Sullivan is the new health and
HHS secretary, and he's gonna be our dedication speaker next week.
But the point of this meeting, Tommy, is that what our commission proposed was that a few of these key strategic people that were dealing with the president's health ought to meet as early as possible.
I just wanted to get that in perspective, that he's out of this part of
it. He's out of it, but he's the kind of guy that I would cross-ref almost anything I did with him.
Right.
Maybe not something like this as much. This is setting up, almost from a lawyer's point of view, the constitutional way we're mm-hmm. going to go about this. I don't want, if the president gets disabled, which is almost certainly will happen sooner or later, for there to be people running around the White House saying, I'm in charge. You know, all this stuff. Let's set that up in advance, no jockeying for position, and because the turf, I cut out another thing. Birch Bayh, who you quoted, who is one of the architects of the 25th Amendment, says, I do not know if it is the drinking water at the White House or what it is, but there is an environment down there, and I don't think any of us fully appreciate it unless we've had a chance to work outside the president's door, that affects everybody that is submerged in that. It is a tenacious desire to hold on to presidential power and not to trust other people with it. Mm. And you can say, obviously, anybody who's been down there knows, and even people who have not been down here know that that's the case in spades. So if you don't set it up in advance, I can see when the bell rings that there are a lot of people that say, yeah. Get out of my way, pal. I mean, this is...
Yeah, I'm in charge.
I'm definitely in charge, you know. And Sununu is, and Boyd and Gray are very independent thinkers, as we've seen already. Anyway, I look to this group for little pieces of advice here on stuff I haven't read and little bogs that I might get into, little problems that I may not see.
Could I just mention one, and then you can talk to people who know something about the subject, but all the political scientists say that the medical people, at least they did at the very beginning of our commission, and they do in the literature, that the people who really know the president's capacity to function best are the White House staff. They see him carrying out his duties, and they know whether he can or cannot make decisions. It's a little bit analogous to the whole business of Tower and Gary Hart. If it doesn't affect the capacity of the president to carry out his duties, and Dean Rusk once said, for instance, to me that he never saw Kennedy in any way unable to carry out his duties, whatever he might have been doing extracurricularly.
Yeah.
And so that's kind of the White House view. If he's doing the job, we know best, we've seen him. Arthur Miller's panel had a lot of that in the discussion. What do you say when people make that argument?
Well, this 25th Amendment is fairly simple, up to that fourth point, you know, Section 4, which is really what you're talking about. And that relates to when the president thinks everything's okay, but other people don't think everything's okay. Could I, before I get back to that, can I ask, from the legal point of view, I wasn't sure in here, up until Section 4, is it necessary that a paper be signed here someplace? Is it necessessary?
In 3?
Well, it seems to me that he...
If he's disabled, let's say he's shot and he's in the operating room, and I say, or deputy or the medical people say he's disabled. We have papers now, these papers being carried in the football. But is it necessary before we transfer the powers to the vice president that a paper be signed?
It seems to be that way. You have to transmit it to the Speaker of the House and the President pro tem of the Senate. Otherwise, you're thrown into four. In other words, unless the president sends a piece of paper up there, the other say nothing to the operative.
Okay, yeah. So what we have, yeah. I just wanted to be sure, yeah. that in other words, we have Barbara Bush should have the ability to sign that piece of paper. No?
I don't know whether she cares. No, yeah. no. In other words, it seems to me you need that piece of paper as he's gone to the operating room. He has to
yeah, but suppose he can't sign a piece of paper. That's
then I think you're thrown into four, where I think the cabinet, you have some idea? Go ahead, Ken. You?
Well, I think a key question that these legal eagles are going to ask you, and in fact, a woman legal eagle asked me the other night, and she said it was legal, is that he can pre-sign this.
Mm.
Before he gets signed?
Yes.
Well, before
have it on file. Have it on file, undated, but signed. And this is the question. When I've talked about this, and there's always a lawyer in the audience, this is the question they say. And then the question is that constitutional?
Yeah.
If it's known to have been signed, but dated at the time of his shooting.
Well, that's a kind of power of attorney, but don't you have a special power of attorney that the president exercises for this purpose, with the understanding of exactly what it means.
Mm-hmm. Would it be like the resignation that cabinet members signed when taking office?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think those resignations don't rise to the level of a kind of a constitutional issue here. I mean, the answer here will be what five justices say if this ever comes up there in the hurry. But it seems to me, why is it so bad to have an immediate meeting of the cabinet and the vice president and just have it just nice and clear?
Is that what the, is that, was that the intention of the people that wrote this amendment?
A four?
No, not a four.
A three, yeah.
Stopping before four. Here.
If you read three and go back to the hearing, I think it was absolutely temporary. I mean, for a temporary situation, and that the president was in, had all his marbles when he signed Section 3.
Yeah.
And you know, when Reagan said he wasn't going to use it, if you read back in the testimony, it was exactly written for anesthesia. As a matter of fact, I think anesthesia attention for 3.
The argument with the assassination attempt was that he could have signed it then. He was still conscious. But then there's a question, and the prior arrangement was informal arrangements between the president and vice president. And I gather, Marty, that there is some cloud over the legality of those, or at least it's uncertain.
Well, there wasn't anything in the Constitution, these old arrangements. Is that what you're talking about?
Yes,
And people just, it became a common law. People accepted it. And I think inasmuch as we now have a constitutional provision, I think we ought to live with it. I think a pre-signing doesn't have the delivery by the president. He never delivered it. I think Ken is absolutely right. I haven't studied those hearings the way you have, but I think it strikes me that the intent of that was that he's conscious, he knows what he's doing, and he says, okay, now, if he signs it beforehand and says deliver it, that's okay, that doesn't bother me.
What I'm talking about
is a conscious act on his part at the time.
It's the Kennedy type thing.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. The guy gets brain damage.
Mm-hmm.
Then what happens?
Four.
And how do you get the paper signed? You don't get it signed?
No, he's four.
Four,
he doesn't sign.
He doesn't. You just call the cabinet, you have the president and vice president, and they send it up there.
So there's going to be time. It's going to be a
that could be done very quickly.
I would think in Dallas that Johnson would have gotten the cabinet together, bang, and Johnson's acting president. Or the Garfield thing, you know, the 60 days in a coma. If you talked, you ought to have lunch with Birch. You'd have fun with him if you ever got time. Because he thought so much of what had gone on previously. And then the other thing he was worried about, I better be careful how see that. If you read between the lines in the hearings, is let's not set up something for a vice presidential coup.
Mm.
And you know, it's always sort of let's not set up a situation where that can happen, even though we think in America that'll never happen.
So you're asking Dr. Lee how to avoid the delay with four. The whole process with four is a very slow-moving process. And how do you activate it instantaneously in the Kennedy?
Well, I would say that...
that's the key to it.
You have a conference telephone call right away. I don't see them going being in a room together, but just having a conference telephone call, one would hope the vice president would initiate this and just put it on the phone and say, here's a president shot, and we would like to exercise, and he should be familiar with Section 4, and want to send this up to the President Pro Tem and the Speaker of the House, period. Now, I don't know whether there's any signature required by everybody there. I don't find out what 4 says, Ken, or the
no,
here,
but I
don't know if it thanks.
But I think Dr. Reed's got a point that in all our hearings, I don't think we discussed, and that is urgency of getting four carried out. You know, suppose Congress is not in session.
Mm-hmm. Well, and the guys in Alaska
fishing
for trout.
You send the President Pro Tem and the Speaker. Doesn't call for a congressional meeting.
For four?
Not that.
Well,
four, you have to approve the Vice President's recommendation.
No. That's when he regains, is when he seeks to regain it, isn't it?
Yeah. Actually, if there's a fight.
Yeah.
If there's a fight, then you have to, you know, then you have this whole question of Congress convening and acting within 21 days. But,
see, one of the things it says, Mr. Kaplan, it says whenever the vice president and a majority of either the principal officers or the executive departments.
We're talking about the cabinet now.
We're talking about the cabinet.
Right.
Then it transmits it. So it's the thing that I would like to avoid, if possible, is that 2 or 3 day period when the president's out and you have a group of very powerful people jockeying for position in the White House.
Mm-hmm.
And you have Jimmy Baker, and you have a Boyden Gray, and you have a John Sununu, each one of whom's got a different idea, particularly, let's face the facts, when you have a relatively weak vice president that some people may not want in at a at a given point in time.
At Grover Cleveland's expedition in the Hudson to have his jaw cancer done kept away from the vice president, hidden from the vice president.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Is it in the spirit of this thing to create a document of some kind where can a power of attorney? Is power of attorney a constitutionally acceptable concept?
You know what might be interesting? You obviously discussed this with the people in the White House staff, but to ask the Department of Justice for some sort of an opinion on
this.
Have it published.
It's very important.
They have an Office of Legal Counsel over at the Department of Justice.
I would really prefer that too, rather than just let Gray decide it, you know?
Yeah, that's right. We never got to this.
Who's the fellow in the department?
I said who they have there now, but... As a matter of fact, Rehnquist at one time when he... That's the position he had. He was an assistant attorney general in charge of that.
Is Dan Metter's student still in the Department of Justice who wrote the articles? What's his name?
I don't know.
No, Casa Grande.
No, that's not right. It's Italian, but I can't remember.
There's a slight analogy with the living will here.
Yeah.
And that's in a state of somewhat limbo, but it's very much in the public eye.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And that needs to be taken into account.
See, I had, in response to an earlier comment here, Ken said, number one, what I wanted out of this really was to be able to use Mrs. Bush in this role, because she is, we have a wife in place there who is exceptional, who accepts the premise that she doesn't just dive for her husband's best interests, that the presidency and the country have priority. She, you know, I mean, the woman is intelligent, very well balanced, stable, and I've talked to her. I said, you know, prior wives all run to cover their husbands' tails the second something happens, and you know, you're just, you know, I'm lucky. If I were with almost any prior first lady, I would not be able to sit here and say I can count on her.
Here and here. Mm-hmm. And she enjoys general respect in the press, everything.
Yeah.
She's Lily White.
Yeah.
Well, as I thought, we agreed on the commission. Doesn't this informal agreement that grows out of the meeting between the presidential physician, the vice president, the first lady, the attorney general, or whoever you bring into the picture, doesn't that have some quasi-legal status in dealing with an instant situation? I thought the whole purpose of their having the meeting was to map out a kind of modus operandi to do something quickly when you had to do something, rather than waiting for the next day, having the president's physician appear before the cabinet. Nobody knows him. The vice president hadn't met him before, and everything was in shadow. But if the First Lady and the Vice President in particular agree on certain procedures in advance, and if that's written into a document, I thought that was the way you dealt with the immediate situation.
Yeah, and I thought we were really getting away from that. I thought we said that there was some cloud over these informal agreements in light of the amendment that we now have. That these informal agreements were before we had anything, when there was, you know, big void, but that, you know, really question whether those informal agreements are now operative. At the same time, I mean, what we were really saying was that everybody ought to be carefully versed in the mechanics of this amendment. Now that we're now discussing little interstices where it's not covered by the amendment completely, and the issue on the table is whether or not you really can give a power of attorney to Mrs. Bush to make some decision on behalf of the president or somebody. Now, you know, we're really getting to the question, could the president have a power of attorney exercised in favor of somebody else? And I think that this is the question I'd like to have put before the Attorney General's office and have something definitive which would calm the public, something that was accepted as legal, interpreted as legal, and therefore would be operative in the event we had such a cataclysm. I mean, I could see, I mean, in under those circumstances, they might well rule that you had a pre-signed document and the president appoints somebody and said, now you have the authority, the discretion to make delivery of this document. That's what we're really saying.
Have you seen Fred Fielding's book yet, prepared toward the middle of the Reagan administration, after the assassination?
Oh, I got your references to it, but I have not seen it. My mind tends to, probably erroneously, shy away from trying to predict every scenario, because I know that when the bell rings, it's not going to be in that book. I would prefer it if I had some real ground rules and then figure out the scenario. That's the way I would prefer myself to do it. And I want to make sure I got all the ground rules set. To get away from this for a second, on the section four, see, of course, as I've told Barbara, and I haven't told the president this, my most difficult task would be if he becomes mentally ill in the White House.
Oh, yeah, probably far.
And that, of course, does get you into exactly the interstices of Section 4 as it's written. But what I didn't see is if I run into, if he becomes sick, we have no problem. If he gets shot and ends up in an intensive care unit, I foresee pandemonium.
And the person most likely to be shot with it is Mrs. Bush.
No.
No.
She travels with him, really. Looking at the prior 13 scenarios of when the presidents have been shot or attempted assassinations, the president's wife is very, I can't remember, has she ever been with him?
Kennedy.
Oh, that's right.
Yeah.
What about your access? And the question of your...
Whether I get shot?
No, whether you're there or not.
Actually, I'm wearing my vest right now.
No, it's a memo.
I mean, do you have... What kind of access do you have to the president? How frequently will you be traveling with him?
I have very, very excellent access to the president. Mm-hmm. But I have not structured my job so that I am playing a William Lukash. I am not following this guy around wherever he goes.
Didn't he make a statement on that recently? Or am I wrong? I thought he was asked about that by the press, and I thought there was some observation. I could be wrong on that.
I'd be interested what that was, because I missed it.
Who, Bill? Or
no, I thought the president, somebody asked him about this, a one interview.
He told me, when I discussed that aspect of the job, because it bothered me, he says, you can get the military guys to do all that.
Yeah.
He did that off the shoulder. Well, getting down to nuts and bolts, I have a fantastic staff at the White House.
Do you keep some of those?
I've kept all of them.
Buttons?
I've kept all of them.
That guy, the pulmonary guy, is fantastic.
Yes.
From
yes.
the target.
Larry Moore. Yeah. No, I've kept all of them. I've been very, very impressed with the caliber of the people, the nurses. The lowest ranking guy we got is a physician assistant who was the number one medical guy who moved with the Delta counterterrorist group for several years. And he was equipped to do all of the military physical stuff with them and also was their best medical guy to treat them if anyone got hurt. I mean, this guy is so much better, if the bell rings, than I would be at handling the freight. And I've been on maneuvers with the Secret Service just with him, and I've watched him operate, and the guy is a super pro under the various things they throw at you.
Just as a small issue, which I don't know whether it's come up or not, but one of the, and I'm sure you've talked to Dan over the phone, but one of Dan's biggest problems was Secret Service.
Dan
Ruggie.
Oh.
Picking the hospital where the president was going to be. And they picked the hospital, one, because there was protection, or they could protect the president. Dan wanted it where there was medical care.
Yeah.
And there was a constant friction over that four-year period, and you may run into that. I have no idea.
Well, I'll tell you, I have gotten to be, I have taken a lot of pains to get to know the Secret Service guys.
And the whole team,
personally.
That whole, what do they call it, that follows the president, there's a for the team that takes the president around.
Well, Quayle has 150 of them.
Yeah.
The president has 250 of them. the two guys who run the Quayle's operation, Hubie Bell and Ray Shattuck, who runs the president's operation, I've had long, long, long sessions with them, and I plan to have a lot more because I have to work very closely with them. I want to work very closely with them. I don't really see. I have so far not seen any big problem. You see, what he's referring to is before the president goes anywhere, We do advances, pre-advances. We flood the area where he's going to go with medical people, Secret Service people, and everything is figured out in advance. If he goes, just gives a 10-minute speech in Buffalo, that all has to be done. But
will a medic be there? Will one of your representatives?
Yes, yes. If I'm not with him and my military people are going, one of them, if I'm not there, is going to be with him. I'm going to be with him on all the international stuff. But most of these shootings are domestic.
Another thing Dr. Ruby complained about was that on a thing like international travel, he had a conviction that the president ought to rest every time he crossed three time zones.
Yeah.
And he said the political and the Secret Service people were always debating that with him.
Well, just from a practical point of view, I'm not going to argue all those things. I mean, it seems to me that that kind of thing is self-evident. Telling George Bush that he's got to wear his rubbers and he's got to sleep 3 hours a day and so forth is really useless, to be honest with you. He's one of these guys with enormous, vibrant energy, and I don't want to waste my muscle on issues like that. He listens to me, and I don't want to start nitpicking with him. So I'm not likely to get into that kind of thing.
You know, when you suggest Mrs. Bush as the person to exercise that authority, I somehow feel that it might rest more easily if you had that authority.
Well, I'm going to insist that I'm the one that says he's disabled.
Right, exactly. Okay. And I think that, you know, she's the one who picks up the phone.
And when do you have that meeting with this group? Next week?
No, because by the nature of the group, it's taking a lot of time to put that
together. Because it seems to me you need to establish this yesterday.
Yes. No, so far...
Thank God the White House staff is not going to say when he's in.
No, I have basically told the president that, and Barbara that, and if I'm superseded on basic medical, I mean, I'll get pushed around politically, but I'm not going to be pushed around that. We have to reestablish, per this paragraph two here, we have to reestablish the role of the physician in the White House and make sure that people respect it in a proper way. Now, of course, one of the there are many reasons that this is the case. In the first place, he's almost always been a military physician.
Yep.
And a military physician really cannot throw their weight around.
You don't tell the boss what to do.
Huh?
You don't tell the boss what to do.
They are in very difficult position. It is one of the reasons why we're having a very nice startup in the office now, because they look at me as somebody that can grab things that they simply aren't going to grab.
Work out of a packed suitcase.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Now, on the other hand, they are super at stuff I really am not terribly eager to get into. So
sounds very promising. Can I ask you about the Bush, Barbara Bush, power of attorney? Does that set a kind of precedent?
Well, I'm sure it does. That's why I don't know.
Yeah.
The proper way to
go. I would almost sort of underscore this point of having that power of attorney in the hands of Dr. Lee, so far as kind of the whole mechanism of this.
I don't think they'd ever give it to me, though. Do you?
I don't know.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Because looking at why these things never work out, it's fairly easy to see. You have people who get up to that level are power crazy.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so many of them.
Sure.
And they don't know who the future doctor is going to be. So often, really, the chief of staff has, well, even Jimmy Baker really, for the first 4 years, ran the country.
Mm-hmm.
And he ran it very, very successfully. And, the president ran into difficulty when he changed his chief of staff.
Are there certain key areas where you've talked at all about establishing your role? For example, Don Regan and Fred Fielding brought the first letter to the president after the cancer surgery. Then he sent them back and said, try it again, rewrote, and then they came back with a second letter, and he signed that. And after the surgery, 7 hours later, they went in, and we asked, and he said he could sign, and we asked him, did you ask the presidential physician? And they said, no, but we asked, with all due respect, some of you, we asked the surgeon.
Yeah.
And all the presidential
That is definitely not going to happen. I mean, I can tell you that.
Make sure.
No, it is definitely not. For instance, Mrs. Bush now has...
The surgeons are all right, but everything's always all right.
Mrs. Bush now has a very tricky, you know, Graves' disease, which she's talked about it in the press, so she broke it, so I feel at liberty to talk about it in this group. And we've had some, a couple of excellent outside people in. We had the top guy at the Mayo Clinic, who turns out to be just about the best guy in the country at the eye manifestations of Graves' disease.
He should. They've Bob, seen more than anybody in the world. Who'd you get, Bob?
That's Bob
Can't remember his name.
Waddell or
Waller.
Waller.
Yeah. Did you say it? Good for you, Ann.
Know where the brain power is.
Now, Ann, what was I going to say next?
You've got two people to see, Barbara.
Yeah. And
it's interesting for, as an old expert, quote, a pseudo expert in Graves, is whether the tension of running for the presidency produced her illness.
Yeah.
That's a side issue.
No, there are many very interesting side issues. But one of the things that I have made very clear, I didn't have to worry about Bob Waller. He is
a
super, super guy. I mean, he is a real gentleman, and it was one of the best moves I ever made to bring him in. But I've explained to everybody that there's one voice on this thing, and it's mine, and that there'll be no interviews, there'll be zero, unless it comes out with a written statement from my office. And that will be, we'll keep that. We don't want what happened with Reagan's surgery to have seven voices talking about what's going on. This business about whether they give me power of attorney, I doubt that. I mean, obviously, in civilian life, in normal life, I would be the guy that would do that. But they did having some sort of Thornburg approving some sort of legal document that would be signed. I mean, for God's sakes, certainly in normal life, the wife should be able to do that.
Question, who makes delivery? In other words, you have the pre-signed document, there it is, sitting there in the football, and who sends it out?
The check's on the wife. Yeah. The wife has historically, I'm sorry to say, been the problem. You know, big problem.
Right.
But the check on the wife, it seems to me, would be the doctor. In other words, the doctor says the guy's disabled. Then her hands are tied. Okay, because he can go over her head to the mechanism in Section 4.
Yeah.
All through the discussion, everybody kept saying the vice president is a pivotal factor in all of this. Remember those discussions?
Sure.
What are the chances? Incidentally, we tape everything here, but nobody will see it except you. Until you say that it can go into our archives. Yeah. But is there any chance of an understanding with the vice president early in the game?
I talked to him yesterday. I spent half an hour with him looking into his baby blue eyes. And I talked to him about this, trying to get some reaction. I got really no reaction.
So what's new?
Yeah. So I said, well, I'm going to go ahead with this, and I'm going to go ahead with this meeting. And I said, I want to try to establish the lines of authority as rapidly as possible and with prior agreement so that when something happens, and I said, I want your input, and please think about this and let me know, or let somebody know prior to the meeting so that we can get together on this. But he was fairly bland about it.
In the article when Altman interviewed you, somewhere, I think it's in that article, that it states that Hart, who is Deputy White House Press Secretary.
Who?
Hart.
Hart?
H-A-R-T. Mm-hmm. And it's in Larry's article, I think. I could find it. That Hart has a contingency plan for the transfer of presidential authority. We don't have we don't have Larry's interview, the last one, do we?
He calls me once a week.
Hart's title was Deputy White House Press Secretary. Does that make sense? Yeah, White House Press Secretary. Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, he'd work for Fitzwater, was that?
That's right.
Marlon Fitzwater.
Yeah. And it was labeled Contingency Plan for Transfer of...
didn't we get that from Fielding that there was...
Well, he said he had one, but then when Dan wrote to get it, he said, well, I don't know where it is. I left it there.
I see. Mm-hmm. But I assume that someone, either previously or at present, is working on putting together a book, and that this would be up to date and reflect your thinking.
It's got to be his thing.
That's right, exactly. I mean, it ought to be reviewed and modified, etc.
There are a lot of things I don't know about what's hanging out there. As you might expect, not too many people, first of all, are interested in talking about this.
That's right.
Number two, giving away some authority is not what they love doing in the White House. Number three, I'm not entirely sure that Vice President Quayle knew what the 25th Amendment was, and things of that nature. So sorting through it. See, for instance, when you can read, at least in your book, when you read about Fielding and Reagan going into the president with this document to sign, it sounded like two little kids going to mummy to see if they'll let them go have another ice cream cone, you know? I mean, it was, gee whiz, do you think he'll sign it or do you think he won't sign it? I mean, all of that stuff really has to be, I don't think anyone had ever talked to Reagan about it. Did they? Really sit down and talk to him about it?
I don't think Ruby did. I don't think so. They may have talked.
See, it's in their tremendous self-interest to do this, because I've told the president, I said, I want to do this and make sure that it's done, if humanly possible, the way you want it done. You know what I mean? So we want this executed the way you want it done right now while you're in the full powers of your
that's the most
early days.
That is key. Yeah.
And so is Barbara Bush.
Yeah.
We tried one strategy before we knew you were going to be sitting in this position. And Chalmers Roberts, who's another person you ought to talk to sometime, who wrote this report. Ken is used to writing prescriptions, I'm used to writing theories of international relations. Mm-hmm. We would have done a lousy job with the report. But Cal Roberts, who was a correspondent and columnist for the Post, actually wrote the report and did an enormous amount of research. And he's one of these guys that sparks ideas, and I think he's also a guy who keeps confidences. I don't know what you would say. But he had the theory that he picked up in Washington, because he still circulates a lot, that because Nancy Reagan made a speech on this very subject to, I think it was the oil, was an oil group once, in which she put forward the view that the president is immortal like every other person. He gets sick, he becomes incapacitated. She resented the fact that being the person closest to him and knowing what happened to him, that nobody consulted and paid any attention to her view. Part of it was the Don Regan, Nancy Reagan feud. But she went public with this, and I've got the speech someplace, if I turn it up. But that suggested to Chalmers Roberts that really, if you wanted to get a key person in this area, you ought to try to get to the First Lady to get her to start something.
Well, and it's a matter of how you deal with it. That's why it's so difficult to be sure of what's going to happen in advance. For instance, Jimmy Baker played Nancy Reagan like Yehudi Menuhin. He would say, ah, yes, we need this done, we need that done with the president. I'm going to call Nancy. And he would do, and the next thing you know, the president would do something. The next guy did it wrong. And they had World War VI.
Yeah.
I have an extremely good relationship with Mrs. Bush. She's so I have no worries about that one. And furthermore, she has a very good relationship with President Bush. He really listens to her. He pretends he doesn't, but he really listens to her.
Seems to me, of the many things that you want to talk about with your group, where you play a key part, is in the last two lines of section 3, when it says the president can decide when he will take back the office. And I think that we have two situations where the president took back the office, which were catastrophic. We don't have definite proof of this yet, except from Donald Regan's book, in which it looks like that post-cancer, when he took back the office, that he probably really did say something about Iran and doesn't remember.
Yeah.
And, a 76-year-old man under anesthesia. I don't want him to even drive a car. Let alone drive the world. So it seems to me this is a very important part of saying that you will decide. Not Stununo or...
There obviously will be political considerations if some crazy thing happens, but other than that, those things, I'm taking it as a given. If somebody tells me that I can't do that, well, that's the end of the job. I mean, it's not really, there isn't a job.
It seems to me that any procedural book would have to address that well. In other words, as well, we're talking about the power of attorney, but the question is, who will be in on the decision-making? Number one, send the letter over there, transferring the power, and taking it back. You have to be involved on both sides of that.
I have to. One thing I haven't seen is what letters they are carrying in that football.
But I assume there's a document, a little booklet.
There is.
Safety rules.
There is. I think Fred Fielding's book is clearly around. Right. I believe it's.
In this thing of heart, he may have just picked up Fred's book. Contingency plan.
How do you face the argument that, again, the political people will make that George Bush, 40% functioning, is worth Dan Quayle, 100% functioning?
Well, That's what I'm talking about. That's the tough one that I have talked to Barbara about, and I haven't talked to the president about, is how we handle a thing like that. And that's obviously the most sensitive thing, and I can't give you any answers. It just has to be everything has to be handled as it comes to you. If the 40% of his brain that makes decisions is gone, it'll be different than the 40% that whether he has good balance or something. You know, I agree. I think that's a terrible decision. I have talked to Vice President Quayle in the silence of this lonely room. I can tell you that I'm not sure a hell of a lot is going from one ear to the other. He is an extremely nice guy, a very, very nice guy, very comes on like gangbusters in a social situation. But there's an awful lot of very basic stuff that he doesn't know. You know, I mean, like, who won the World Series last year?
Will he listen? Is he listening and learning?
Yes. Yes, he is. He is. I'm a little bothered myself by the fact. Now, this is all personal, nothing to do with any official role. I'm a little bothered myself by the fact that he has gradually surrounded himself, I guess, as every vice president does, with his own advisors. In other words, and I'm not impressed with the quality of his advisors. Now, I don't know all of them. I've dealt with his office now on several occasions. I don't think that the man is reading what comes into his office. I don't know who is. I don't like the way they deal with me. I don't like the way they deal with other people.
He's a threat to
no,
their power or what?
Well, up until yesterday or a day or two ago, they viewed me not as a threat, they viewed me as insignificant.
Oh. Mm-hmm.
Okay? And that's, you know, his level of perception of what's going down is such that that can happen. In the first place, it's stupid to view anyone as being insignificant in the White House who has constant access to the president and is a friend of his for 35 years.
Does he want you to think you want to take his pulse about it?
I think maybe something like that, you know. I told his secretaries 52 times that was not the case. I wanted to talk to him about other things, but I don't think his judgment. Once I get in, the guy is super, super nice and follows me into the hall and says, gee, can't we play golf together and so forth and so on. But I said, no, we can't, because I got a 20 handicap and you got a 6. But,
his most important role, his exclusive role, really, is this 25th Amendment.
Yeah.
He ought to know that.
Sure, he's the guy that it operates
on. It's only official function in this country.
But one reason this situation exists is that there's been no Wilson Newman in the White House vice president's operation. Wilson Newman, even if we wanted to at the Miller Center, would never let us become an advocacy center. We have Strom Thurmond one day and Arthur Schlesinger the next day, and we literally have tried to, as you well know, to avoid that kind of thing.
Very
but,
good.
But Irving Kristol's son, a fellow that was denied tenure here, Carnes Lord, a number of people who are on the far, far right think they know all the answers to politics are the people that Quayle has staffed his group with, and they are they're extreme ideologues and extreme advocates. And they're going to have to learn. Maybe they'll learn. People on the left sometimes learn. People on the extreme right sometimes learn. But some of them don't.
And the monarchies, the regent was always appointed from a child who became king. We should have something in the contingency plans for that. He would accept.
It's going to be interesting in the discussions to see how that's going to be handled. I happen to know, Jimmy Baker reasonably well, and his statements on the vice president have been widely spread in the press. If Jimmy Baker was the chief of staff and we were dealing with this, I'm sure we would get into some very interesting discussions about when we would declare the president to be disabled. I don't know what to do about that. Do you have any suggestions? I mean, I know that's going to be brought up. I guess you just got to be very, very careful.
Now this is a highly political question, which really goes outside of the medical field, legal field.
Well, I wasn't thinking so much about his ideology as I was thinking about his capabilities.
Well, I was thinking of that too.
Yeah. I can honestly say that in 20 minutes of talking about the 25th Amendment, I did not see a light go on behind those eyes. So, but I think his wife, the light goes on with his wife. And that's always, it's always worried me when a guy is really run by his wife. I hate to see that, really.
Has any literature been sent to the vice president? Has he seen this report?
That's worth doing.
Yeah, right.
I may do that.
Right, yeah.
Yeah. That's worth doing.
Dr. Lee, you mentioned the psychiatric disability, and I wasn't sure whether you wanted to pursue that a little further. Dr. Norris' chapter in this.
Oh yeah, we have. Yeah.
Suggests a mental health consultant, but I'm wondering how you thought about that.
I collected some of the data on the psychiatric stuff. There was quite a good. You're the psychiatrist?
No, these two.
And one of you is head of the place, aren't you? You were dean.
He was the dean.
Yeah. Did you see the article in the Times about the? They had a full page and a half almost discussion of mental disability in the presidency.
I think this was all about that.
Did you see that?
No, I didn't.
Well, I collected that and I've read some other stuff on it. I have, again, tend to not want to get established psychiatric consultants into the White House because I don't want internecine discussions on a thing that's this delicate. I would prefer again to speak with one voice, and if we saw, my approach, and I want to hear what you have said, is that if I detect difficulties, and I know them very well, I would detect difficulties. We also know his children very well, and a lot of close friends very well, and his wife very well. And I think we'll detect it actually before the White House staff will detect it. And to handle it like any other medical problem, I analyze what the psychiatric problem is, and look around for the best consultant to come in and help us deal with it. I mean, that's my tendency to deal with it just as any other medical problem and get the best, there are great people at manic depression and there are great people at this and great people at old senility problems and old age, and et cetera. What are your thoughts?
I think that's fine. That's a nice approach, and I think that's better than having people sort of on standby because you're...
They feel they have to do something.
Yeah, you're suggesting a need, and you probably don't want to do that. So to be able to call on a small group of people for assistance, I think would be very appropriate. And then the hope would be that you never have to deal with a situation where, in fact, the mental illness is going to disqualify him from being president, because then you're really in it.
You're in a very tough spot.
Oh, terrible. I think, it's an opportunity. The stress of the job is such that you, as the White House physician and a friend, can help the president and his family by being supportive and being helpful to him during periods of high stress, or if in fact the family becomes concerned that he is not sleeping well, you may want to make a careful inquiry into why he's not sleeping well, or if he's drinking too much. So I think you, as the White House physician, can be very supportive, you know, on a real medical operative level. I think your idea about consultants is fine.
I told Mrs. Bush one of the first few days I was in there that in my experience in dealing with, I had a very large practice in New York, and what I would tell my patients is, if you have problems, for God's sakes, come get to me early. Mm-hmm. When you think you have a problem, get to me, because what we have here is the ability to do tremendous things for you beautifully if we catch it early. If we get it too late, you put me in trouble, you put yourself in trouble, you put even all our mechanisms in trouble. So I'm urging you, and I'm urging George, if he has anything wrong, let us know. She said, you don't have to worry. Said he used to have terrific denial about everything, but now the guy's become a hypochondriac. And it's true. He's in my office every day. Well, I need a little Actifed, and I need this and that. So he tells me all those things. So I'm happy about that. I get the flavor of what's going on with him.
Yeah, you can be very very supportive and very helpful. In talking with Dr. Ruge, he felt somewhat lost. He felt like a duck out of water.
Mm.
Described his job, I think, as a
blue collar.
Blue collar. Yeah, he was a blue collar person in the White House, and he did not take any of the advantages that you seem to be taking. He was not aggressive. He was not close to the president. He felt out of it. Dr. Lukash was very aggressive, but in providing service. He indicated to us that he in fact would seek out the vice president if he was concerned about the president being disabled, but really was not very prepared to do that, or really hadn't thought it out very carefully. He was more interested in traveling with the president, providing some service to White House people. So I think the approach you're taking is maybe a first in White House physician history.
I have been...
Well, Bill, Lukash did a minor one, you know, with the hemorrhoid thing. They had the 25th Amendment ready if Carter needed surgery. Remember, that's what Bill told us in Washington. But they... As you know, he didn't go to surgery, so they never used it.
I have been. May I just respond to this, because it's to me this is very into the heart of this job.
Yeah.
I have been struck initially right off the bat not by just Lukash and Rugai and particularly Hutton, who was just there, is they are totally consumed with this job of playing around with the president, following him every second, you know, monkeying around with the person to the point of exclusion of all everything else. I think in the first place it destroys your, if you don't mind my using psychiatric terms, you know, your ego, your id as a doctor. I have a certain concept of myself, and if I put myself in this position, it sort of destroys that concept of myself. I like to feel that I'm holding some cards and I can run the show here when something happens. And if you get pushed around long enough and you're constantly you know thinking of yourself in this mode, then it's very easy when things get tough for them to push you around.
Sure.
I mean, to go to the surgeon who was brought in and ask him, well, is he okay?
Yeah.
I mean, that I would just drive me crazy if somebody did that, you know? So that I have taken a lot of different moves to build up the ego strength of this office and of the doctors in it, of the physician's assistants in it who are fantastic, and of the nurses who are unbelievable. Qualified nurses. I am stopping a lot of this aimless following people around. We are not following Quayle around everywhere he goes anymore. That's cutting back on 30% of our activity right there. We are not covering the president up at Camp David the way he used to be covered. Camp David is run at like a Navy ship. There are a lot of top secret details on how it's run, but I can tell you that it's the safest place that the president ever is. It's much safer than the White House. There is a ton of things at his disposal up there. Cutting back on things like that. I'm volunteering my staff to go out and give talks, give speeches, do consultations, take visiting professorships, give lectures at major societies, getting them back into the mainstream of medicine, getting them back into their own units where they function properly and their ability to think of themselves in a certain way is restored. I have told them that I want to go further than that. I want our office involved with health policy issues. I want us to be able to sit down with the AMA and with the Institute of Medicine and with the healthcare financing. I mean, I want to take it as far as I can possibly take it. Some people will be receptive and some people will not. And I'm going to take it where they want me. I'm not going to push it where they don't. And I hope to remedy some of that. I think I can't tell you how much aimless activity was going on in that office. For instance, you have a cardiac care nurse. The best the Army has to offer runs a cardiac care intensive care unit. When I got there, this girl that week was sitting answering the telephone in the White House residency from 7 in the morning till 10 at night for a week. And, you know, maybe twice a day somebody would come in and say, I need some Jellicle. Now, this is an affront to anything. And, you know, this is not the way we got to run it. So I have immediately taken those nurses off that type of duty. I'm about to fire the secretary that's been there since 1971 who wanders around, and she's gotten used to now the nurses all doing all her work for her. And the hell with it. And we're going to try to restore some normal activities in the office.
Can I ask you a couple of sort of hypothetical problems here? One has to do with the situation in South Africa now, when Botha apparently has had a stroke and he is trying to get back in spite of the fact that he's back. As to whether there's any anticipated kind of problem that represents. And the other is the sort of worst case psychiatric of somebody like Forrestal, and who does not recognize whether any of his relatives or whatever it is.
Well, I am very interested in these problems. I have told whoever wants to listen, I volunteered the services of our unit to all the 1,500 people in the White House for consultations of this type. I happen to know several cabinet secretaries. I mean, my guys are in there now. So, I've told them, people that I've grown up with, or just as a profusion of them in Washington, I've told them, use us. We got a fabulous unit over there. Use us. I have, and this may really interest you, I have been talking to the CIA. And the head doctor for the CIA and I are, I'm going down to Langley. I'm sort of interested in how this is going to work out. I think next week to spend a half a day with the head medical guy at the CIA in Langley. And interestingly enough, the president made that connection for me. And what they do is they analyze foreign leaders, people of particular importance, both, and they try to put personality scenarios. They do an intensive psychiatric analysis in whatever way they can, and medical. And they want to know if I want to be involved in that, in an attempt to predict, for instance, what might happen to a given leader and what might happen to the decision making. And I'm very interested in that, and I'm going to follow up on that. Again, the doctors in my unit have a lot to offer. There's one very good cardiologist, there's one very good pulmonary guy, mm-hmm. and the other guy's a GI guy.
Is the cardiologist Dan Ruge's?
No. Well, he was with
the daughter's friend. Did Dan hire the cardiologist? Has he been there?
I think so. He's been there 2 years, yeah.
No, he wouldn't have been.
Yeah. I was thinking, Hutton hired him. Yeah.
I was thinking more of the possibility of a president having a stroke, being disabled, and then wanting to get back when the...
Yeah. Well, that goes back to the original discussion. That is something... My style at Memorial Sloan Kettering, where I was I became a very tight specialist. I ran the lymphoma service so that I was specialized within a specialty within a specialty, within a specialty, practically. So when I would have people with almost any other kind of problem, I always foraged for the best consultant. And I always took the position, for better or for worse, and you pay the penalty for this, that I was going to get the best person instead of the person that I owed the favor to, which is unfortunately a very common problem in medicine, as you know. Now, I'm going to operate this office this way. We're going to get the best person. And in that type of thing, we have to get the best neurologist, and we have to get the best psychiatrist, and we have to get people in there to help us. I wouldn't in a million years, in the scenario that you're talking about, make that decision all by myself.
I don't want to run this into the ground, but if the president is disabled with a stroke and the vice president takes over, then his physician is in charge. And then when it comes time to replace the vice president with the president, then it's you. What about that?
Well,
that goes to the heart of the matter.
That's why
I would think that the Legal Eagles would have fun with this, because the vice president is acting president. He's no longer vice president, so I don't see why he isn't a physician.
to the act.
Well, Ken, I think that one of the reasons why the White House staff surrounds the president and is very, very cautious about it, anybody else getting into the circle, is that if the decision is made to transfer power to the vice president, he's going to have an awful lot of authority about who he's going to have in the staff. And if he says, I want to replace Sununu, Sununu will be replaced. And if I want my physician will be replaced. He's the acting president of the United States. He has his whole staff.
Yep. Sorry.
Yeah.
Well, I'd listen to you guys help with that one. I am making every move that I can to be friendly to Vice President Quayle. I have told him that I am glad to serve as his physician and that I would be glad to accompany him to Pine Valley anytime he wishes to play golf and so forth and so on. But I obviously, especially with the guys he has surrounding him, if President Bush went down with a stroke, and you're looking at a several-month problem. Man. Well, I guess my wife happens to be a Bahamian, and we have an alternative. I can always take it.
Could I ask a question on a different plane in a way? It has to do with the conflict and the ethical sense of your responsibility to the president as his physician and the other responsibility to the country and so on. Well, I have in mind Lord Moran, who was here with his problem with Churchill when he had his coronet. Mm. And tie this in with your pre-arrangements with the president, whatever they be, in confidentiality, which has changed so dramatically since those days. When Moran just kept it quiet that Churchill had a coronary and let him go on functioning as best he could because Churchill said this is the best for everybody concerned. How does it seems to me the key of this is your pre-arrangement with the president about what's confidential and can be confidential and what can't. And with the press as it is now, I don't see what can be confidential. But could you talk about this a little for me?
Well, we ran into it right off the bat. I walked right into this Graves' disease on day one, and this is sort of they were just starting to fool with her eyes over at Bethesda when I walked in there on day one, and we sort of had a warm up for the kind of thing that you're talking about.
Yeah.
My feeling at the time was, and I stressed it to our office, which I didn't have to do, they operate that way, was that unless we were told otherwise, this was going to be confidential. Now, this was broken rather rapidly by Mrs. Bush, and we've since then had several discussions with Marlon Fitzwater, and he's enlightened me, and obviously you shouldn't keep these things a secret for very long, because if you do, then the press never gets
off. You simply can't in the present day.
Yeah,
that's what bothers.
So I'm a little smarter than I was on day one.
What does that mean?
What that means is we realize that we're going to be treated confidentially, but we also realize that we got a short ripcord on it. I mean, we're going to have to deal with this in a few days. Graves' disease is such a tricky thing, you know. I mean,
especially in the eyes.
Yeah, I just didn't know where this thing was going to go, and I still don't. Still not really sure.
Well, you haven't even got there yet. Wait till you tell the press you're going to give a radioactive iodine and then watch him blow up on nuclear stuff.
Well, that's happening on Tuesday. So, if the president's seriously disabled, the way the Bushes like to operate is openly. They're not a...
It's easier for you.
Yeah, they're not a... We don't have that problem, so I'm sure that, you know, it may take a day or two to sort it out, but there'll be a statement.
Could I just say one word about what the Vice President reads? There is a pattern. There's a good book by Paul Light on Vice Presidents generally, and might want to look at that sometime, but he was here, and now he's an associate director at the Humphrey Center.
What is it?
Paul Light, and I think it's just called The Vice President. But it's not about Quayle, but it's about...
Yeah.
The best book about Quayle is Richard Fenno's book. Richard Fenno is probably the best scholar in the country on the Congress, and he's done case studies on senators. And he did a case study on Quayle, which is very sympathetic and very balanced, bringing out the strength. And I thought of it in terms of Tommy knew very well, the guy who really started the Green Revolution, you may have too, who was ended up as president of the Rockefeller Foundation, George Herrar. Mm. I used to work for him, and he once said, I once asked him, what was the most important thing you did in Mexico? And he said, studied the Minister of Agriculture. And he literally made it his business to find out what made him act and tick. And the problem with Quayle, even accepting all Dick Fenno's positive views about him, is that the literature that has reached him has tended to come from one or two or three places.
Yeah.
When he attacked George Shultz on the INF Treaty, why, he literally read verbatim the Heritage Foundation criticism of the INF. So he gets one or two sources, and I'm sure that Carnes Lords and Crystal would, and others there, would see to it he never read anything from the Miller Center, given their set frame of mind, whereas Chase Untermyer got all our stuff into the White House from the very beginning. On the Chase Untermyer spent a day here going over our reports before he took over.
Terrific.
And if there were some way through some person to get ideas into Quayle from other sources besides the Heritage Foundation and the Hoover Institute, it would be a great
See,
thing.
This is a man who isn't out. Bush. Where, whenever you're with him, he's reading. He has his staff is condensed stuff. And whenever he's on a plane, you're never sitting around shooting the bull. He's always reading the whole time and so forth. Quayle doesn't do that. So he appears to just read what's given him. And nothing I've sent, I had sent several things to his office prior to my meeting, and I was positive after talking to him that he was completely unaware of anything that I had sent. So, I don't know how you solve that. I certainly am not going to be the guy that's going to get the stuff in there.
Well, Carnes Lords is his foreign policy advisor, and one reason he never got tenure here, he's a brilliant guy, a double PhD. In classics and in government. And he's written a kind of revisiting of Aristotle that is an exceptional book.
Mm.
So he's very bright. But Carnes Lord, whatever he did, would never listen to anybody except the people that went 1,000% down his line of reasoning. As a very young man, he told every one of us exactly where we were wrong on everything. And
was he at the University of Virginia?
Yeah, he was an assistant professor.
Mm.
And he killed himself here with that, because in an academic community, whatever your point of view, you've got to have some communication with people of other views.
Mm.
And that kind of person, I think, is as much the threat as the Vice President himself. And yet it seems to me, as Marty was saying, the Vice President, somehow or another, is absolutely essential to this whole process, and George Herrar's notion that somehow or another you got to figure out the Minister of Agriculture is probably the the best guidance politically that one could follow here. Or otherwise you have to go around him. But how do you go around him when at every stage he plays such a critical role?
Here is a person you may want on your consultant list. This is a classmate of Warren Stamps. Bob is a dean at Rochester and has been interested in the same thing I've been interested in for a long time, and has studied illnesses of many people. And also has thought a lot about the 25th. And the reason I bring it up is that there are about 20 papers that will tell you, one, that you need an official commission to help you.
With
anything. The day you went in office, four people should have been appointed that you were to use to see whether Mr. Bush was functioning.
Are you recommending this, you say?
Oh, God, no. You know, we went through that commission, and we had a group of docs ahead of time saying, well, that's ridiculous. And I couldn't be more pleased than have you say, I'm going to make the decision with consultants. Now, the other part about consultants is that you've got a little bit of problem with this out of town.
What do you mean?
I've just been up to Portland and talked to the group that you'll be using in Portland. Have you been up to meet him, or was it just one of your men, Mike?
No, I haven't been. I haven't hit the main scene yet.
Well, anyway, there's some Will D. Said it was a transitional cell carcinoma of the bladder and there was no problem whatsoever. Well,
what?
That wasn't true.
A worse carcinoma?
Yeah, you know, he died within two and a half years after Willie saw him. The guy at Minnesota?
What are you going to do if Whitmore makes a mistake on a bladder cancer? God, I don't know.
Yeah, but the point of it was that I'd be interesting to know, in talking to Willie, whether he ever thought about whether he was talking to the country about the potential candidate for the presidency or whether it was just another patient with transitional cell.
Those things, of course, happen. I've made mistakes. We all make mistakes. Whitmore is if there's a problem, say to take that in perspective. If there's a problem with Whitmore, he's too damn busy.
Sure.
He's crazy busy. I tend not to pick those guys because the chiefs of departments and things like that, because they're. we actually, for Barbara's eye guy, we roughed through four or five names, and there were some super experts, but they had varying ego problems of various types, and this guy Waller was was perfection. That's the problem. Who do you pick? We have a book, though, of consultants across the country.
Mm-hmm.
I'm in the process of going over it again and revising it to the best of my ability in consultation with the various medical organizations and medical schools, and trying to pick the best practical person for the job. We have, you know, this trauma society. They've been fantastic. This group of surgeons, they update it for us every year, and they give us the really best people across the country, and we use them like the Bible. We don't put them in a hospital where one of those people isn't, if we can possibly help it. And
well, you've got the best unit in the country right there at Baltimore and University of Maryland.
Hmm.
Dr. Detmer, do you or Dr. Stamp or Mr. Newman, anybody else want? We want to think of your schedule.
We have all the movers arriving at our apartment. It took Ann and I over three and a half hours to come down here.
Oh, really?
You hit the rush hour?
We hit accident after accident after accident. Oh. We didn't get to Route 29 for over 2 hours.
You took 66. I came down Washington yesterday, and we got caught on 66.
Yeah.
But once you hit 29, you're pretty.
Yeah. Cool. Once we had got 29.
Well, you go 80 miles an hour. He was going. He was going late.
I was going at 80 miles an hour. I didn't want to miss the cocktail hour.
But he has two tickets. So
Dr. Dapper.
Yeah, I do have one question, because I guess the question is, does the president, does the vice president listen to the president?
Well, that's a good question. As near as I can tell, the vice president definitely listens to the president.
Well, if that is the case, then you have an interesting situation, I think, as you approach these issues, because you have a president who has just been a vice president for a long time.
Yeah.
And you have a situation where the vice president also knows that. And as you get into this question, and maybe even before you consider asking the Justice Department, if you get some thoughts of your own in terms of how to relate to this, it would seem to me that with your relationship to the president and to the First Lady, that indeed a sign from the president to the vice president, that in his 8 years, vice president, this seems to be to him the way the best approach to this matter would shake out. And that, but to clarify some of this, you'd like to get some further thoughts from the people over Justice or such. But it seems, if in fact he does listen, vice president listens to the president, in a way you're not quite having hand in that, in the sense of who our president is and his experience, I would think. I don't know, but it's just...
I'll tell you, it's a little bit complicated. The vice president listens to the president, no question, because in the first place, he stands an excellent chance, if he doesn't play really good ball, of being dumped the next time around. However, both Bushes are very, very defensive about Dan Quayle. They don't laugh anymore, ever, if people tell jokes, either privately or publicly.
Oh, they should.
That's the right way. Yeah, and they are very very defensive about him. He's ripped to pieces in that press club meeting and everything else, and it can get very embarrassing. However, Mrs. Quayle is definitely an independent person on the scene, and I don't think Mrs. Quayle listens to anybody but her own drummer, and if Vice President got in, she's going to make Nancy Reagan look like Heidi. I've messed with her a little bit a couple of times, and she is a steely, cold person. When she's looking at you, you know that she is looking at you seriously. I mean, she is aware of all the power machinations in that place, and Dan Quayle is going to do what she tells him to do. So she's really going to end up, if you look at the worst possible scenarios, she's going to end up being the problem. And she does not have a particularly good relationship with Barbara. And vice versa.
It seems to me one of the key questions that we got to this morning that really didn't come up in the 4 years of thinking about this with any group was, how quick can you act if in the Kennedy situation?
alive. Kennedy's alive, shot in the head. And we had Section 3 and Section 4. I don't think Marty or Ken in any of our discussion did we say, how quick will this happen? When we talk about the vice president and the cabinet and all this, we could be without a president for a fair period of time.
It's only on removal, death, or resignation that you have it like that. Then automatically the vice president is in. But other than that, you've got these.
There's a delay. And it's and when you're talking to the attorney general, which I'm sure you will sometimes, it might be important, at least for your own information, the public doesn't have to know, what the hell do we do?
Can the president talk in confidence to the attorney general? Is that a good relationship, as far as you can tell? Because the press has told it both ways. They've said
that's a good point.
Bush, but the other view is he's probably going to leave because he's not quite that close to Bush.
But I think this thing would pass through really on a pretty objective analysis. I don't see any, in terms of the ability to delegate, I don't think it's a partisan issue. And how do we get over this hump over here of the mechanics of transmitting this letter? And can you have a power of attorney with a pre-signed letter work?
Why don't we think about a little very quiet consultation with the stronger legal people like
Yeah, that would be fabulous if this if this group gave me a recommendation for what to do. I would be in a lot better position than I am now because
Well, is
Senator By still in the Senate?
No, he's practicing law in Washington D.C.
Practicing in Washington D.C. Okay.
And if you get in touch with him through his secretary, why emphasize this is a matter of life and death, because otherwise Birch Bayh is the worst person in returning phone calls probably in the United
States. She'll turn you off, but tell her, by God, you tell the senator I want to talk to him.
But he's very into this.
Oh, he still loves it. This is all when he sat here with us for 2 hours before we started the commission.
Yeah, I don't know whether in studying the record can you find any evidence of people considering this issue. I mean, the congressional hearings and all that.
Well, you know, the answer is I go back and look. Or call Birch and say, did you really consider what would happen if you had the Garfield situation? And I don't think we thought about it, did we?
Not in that particular.
We thought about it as going nuts and Alzheimer's and all that. But this is a toughie. The way it's written.
Well, you know, as he pointed out, it was deliberately left vague because it was so political and hot. Everybody's worried about who's going to be the real decision maker here. And so I think they created these vagaries.
See, I can see myself having some reasonable control if a man's ill.
Yeah, you bet.
But I can see myself totally losing it. If we have if he gets shot and he's disabled and we don't have the mechanism to take care of him, and we have to start fooling around with the cabinet and the senator and the head of the House and the head of the Senate, then I will definitely have lost control of it. No question.
Wilson Newman.
I'm glad to see the emphasis that has been placed in this discussion on the legality of the power of attorney, and I'm particularly impressed by what Kaplan's observation of getting from the appropriate, and I emphasize appropriate, source in the first instance, a legal opinion. Personally, it troubles me very much to assume that a power of attorney that in personal life can make a transfer of contractual powers, but it seems to me that the law goes by a different standard when it gets into transferring the political power. Just as an offhand to give an extreme illustration, I don't believe that the president, in his possession of all of his faculties in good health today, can give a power of attorney to Mr. X simply because he wants to transfer the powers of an elective office to an individual of his choosing. And it seems to me that if that is the case, then the lack of the presence of that power is not increased during periods of alleged incapacity unless there is a body of law to support it, and the 25th Amendment seems to me to come into being. I have great trouble with exercising on a prior basis a power of attorney that someone else can make the decision on when it's delivered. And that's the reason why I think that with all of the good intentions, the legal thing, when you get down to it, you put your finger on a very, very crucial decision, it seems to me.
Your tendency would be to stick with it as it's written and go through the, pay the penalty and go through the machinations.
I think the thrust of my uneasiness is that we are inclined to consciously or unconsciously transfer our assumptions and experience with personal property law and the law of an individual. And it seems to me that when you get in dealing with political powers, that the common law, which gave rise to the power of attorney, is inapplicable for an elected official. And I think it goes to have to go directly to the statutory basis, whatever it is, and hopefully the legal opinion that given would be supported by the courts if it came for a test.
Is it fair to ask you to all consider this and
no,
see if you all agree
we'd
with
like
Mr.
To.
Newman? If that's the case, you know, I'd like to know. I mean, this is the major thing out there, as far as I can see, on this problem. I'd like to know that. Be good to know that before I went to see Thornburg. Mm-hmm.
Which, yeah, you don't have a date for
could,
that.
Could
yet.
I
no.
just make one observation in relation to that? I think your analogy of just power of attorney to transfer the power of the presidency to anybody he's choosing is quite inappropriate here. It's to the vice president. It's a very restricted situational power of attorney, as I view it, and I think it could be looked at that way. I'd like to further ask you to continue to defend your right as a physician to keep control of the things you need as a physician to the greatest extent possible, and not to get bogged down in unnecessary legal restrictions, let's put it that way. I think the whole trend nowadays in the medical profession is that we're getting crowded in so that the things you need to do in order to do your job as a physician you can't do anymore. That's just a broad philosophical observation.
Well, I certainly do want to, I want to restore to that office the concept in the White House that they have to deal
yeah.
in medical matters with this office, period.
Right.
And you cannot here, go here. Over you cannot go over their head or there's going to be hell to pay. And so we'll see. We'll see if that bothers Sunula.
Warren, do you want that question?
Yeah.
Would you have wanted to be confirmed in order to have more political power?
I hey, I'm very interested in the problems. I'm very interested in the issues that come before the people in the White House. I mean, that's what I'm really interested in. So anything that allows me to deal more with the issues, I would welcome. And so, yeah, I've insisted, for instance, on a lot of little things which nobody asked for before, which I thought were symbolic, like a burn bag in my office. No, everyone else has important documents that they put in burn bags to see. And it's been assumed that I have no important documents. Well, everything I have is very important.
Cotton swabs.
Yes. Yeah. And, you know, we're talking about, up at the special unit in Walter Reed, you've got sometimes three or four heads of state up there that we're dealing with. And when and where and how they're going to die is pretty interesting information for a lot of people. So anyway, I'm trying to do things like that. If I could be confirmed, I would hope they wouldn't go into my background quite as closely as the Senator Tower. But yeah, sure, I would welcome all of that stuff. So far, I'm starting from scratch, really.
You may set a pattern for the future.
I hope so. I hope that each one who can come in can put a different layer. What I saw was layer upon layer upon layer upon layer of sort of a running around type responsibilities. Oh, well, now we'll follow the president's, or the vice president's wife a little bit more. Now we'll do this, now we'll do that. I just am stripping all that back and trying to build it up in a different way.
I really think your relationship with the president, Mrs. Bush, is so crucial that they have confidence in you and that the public perceives this. And I think they would accept word from you later on with so much more grace and appreciation. I think it's terribly important that that be strengthened and known.
It is important.
Yes.
Because I can see, if you have just a straight military guy in that office, I see the way things go, and they just.
Yeah.
I mean, for instance, they had a single. The chief of staff put through a single directive. After I was, you know, I had about three turf wars my first week. One of them was that the chief of staff put through, and I didn't decide to fight this one, I might add. So I didn't fight one, I lost one, and I won one. Not bad for the first week. But the one that I decided not to fight was a directive that was from Sununu's office that says, all the military personnel in the White House will now not come into the West Wing anymore. They will not ride on Air Force One unless we have the following few exceptions. And what happened is the first week, my major Air Force nurse, for God's sakes, it's Air Force One the man's traveling on, right? My major Air Force nurse, with six empty seats on Air Force One coming back from a distant location, was bounced and told she could not go on Air Force One and had to go with the car. The car goes, and the car plane leaves 6 hours later, and they sit on metal seats that sort of come down, and it's cold, and it's bangy, and it's not pressurized right. And she got in at 4 a.m., and I was outraged. I went upstairs. Actually, I did win part of this one, because I said, my people aren't going to be treated that way. That's all there is to it. If there are seats on Air Force One and my medical people are out there, they're going to be on Air Force One. And there's a woman who runs the White House. All the administrative stuff, I found a friend. And I got lucky. She said, don't even begin to worry about it. That'll never happen again. But they tend to do that with the military, you know. And so a military doctor running that, I can see it's got problems. And I love the military myself. The people are crackerjack. I'm simply not used to being treated this way.
Mm-hmm.
I'm used to fighting cats and dogs for everything. I'll say something in the office like, I don't think we should be doing the following thing. And the next day, it's simply never done anymore. You guys ought to join the army.
It is wonderful.
Yeah.
Well, thank you very, very much. This is right. Mr. Howard.
Thank you. I really am. I'm so happy that I ran across this and heard Brad L. and all of you. And if you can get back to